This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 195 was recorded on Wednesday, November 27th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Happy Thanksgiving. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, which happens to be my favorite podcast when it comes to quant and rules-based investing. CPM Group founder Jeffrey Christian is best known as a precious metals expert, and we have a Jeff Christian double feature planned for this holiday week in the markets. We'll start off with Jeff joining me as our feature interview guest for a discussion about electric vehicles. Now, that interview was actually taped earlier this year and produced in advance to air this week so that we could give our hardworking production staff some much-deserved time off for the holiday. It's an excellent interview, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it. But since it was produced well in advance, it doesn't contain any commentary about current market conditions in precious metals. And with the precious metals market suddenly being the focus of so much investor attention, that presented a real conundrum. So we said, the heck with giving our production staff the time off that they deserve, and instead we made them work overtime so we could invite Jeff back to join us again for a second interview, which will air in today's post-game segment. Now, unlike the feature interview, which was recorded earlier this year, the post-game discussion with Jeff was taped this week, and it includes an up-to-date analysis and outlook on precious metals.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's jump into the analysis of the markets, and starting with the S&P 500, which is wasting no time just trugging along to new highs. What's going on?
Well, up and away. And you got to hand it to Juliet DeClercq and Pippa Malmgren and others that we've had on the program who have expressed very bullish outlooks in the last few months. And it's being proven true. Now, Charlie McElligott told us to expect a pullback potentially in equity markets in the second half of November. I guess we sort of kind of got one, but it was short lived and it was very shallow, much smaller than what Charlie had predicted. So I think he got the timing right in terms of the factors that were going to lead to a little bit of a soft patch. It was just a much smaller soft patch than expected, and it seems like the melt-up is upon us. I really think that the trade deal optimism is really just the excuse the market is using. Certainly, the various moves up and down are being punctuated by changes in perspective about the trade deal, but frankly, I think the real driving factor is easy money, driving share buybacks. I still don't think the economic fundamentals really justify this, but frankly, that's irrelevant. Market is definitely trending higher, and it seems like there's plenty of monetary policy stimulus that could set the stage for this melt-up to continue for quite a while.
All right, well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar index, because the euro continues to be weak. There's actually a number of currencies, cross-currencies, that are showing relative weakness, and the dollar index is it's above 98, and it continues to edge higher. Do you think the dollar's going higher from here?
Well, you know, I think the key word there is edge higher. What we really need is a decisive close above that interim high that we saw back on the 13th of November, which was around 98.28 or so. What are we looking at? 98.29, one tiny little tick higher as we're speaking on Wednesday afternoon. I think we really need to see a daily close over 98.50 to properly establish a pattern of higher highs and higher lows that would tell us that this rally that we're seeing off of 97, where it bottomed, maybe has legs to it. Of course, the really big test is going to be a daily close above 99.50, a new cycle high, and that would really tell us that there's room for this to continue to the upside. So right now, we're almost there in terms of establishing that pattern of higher highs and higher lows. We just need a daily close a little bit higher than where we are right now.
All right, so let's move on to crude oil, which was trading along the high of the week, and then we got those inventory numbers, create some volatility. Does this change any? How did the inventory numbers come in, and what's your thinking on oil here?
Well, I think the first part of what you said is probably going to be more important. That persistent bid has been there. It's been pressuring the price of oil right on its resistance, and it hasn't really broken out above resistance in a meaningful way, but it hasn't retreated either. Now, Patrick, when we got a bearish inventory report today, and I'll just go ahead and give you those numbers now, it's crude oil building 1.6 million barrels nationally, Cushing, Oklahoma drawing down a de minimis 97,000 barrels. It's a drawdown, but a really small drawdown. And remember, the Keystone Pipeline, although it has restarted, is operating at reduced pressure after the recent spill. That means less throughput and less oil from Canada coming into Cushing. So the fact that it's only small drawdowns in that environment is probably a reassuring sign in terms of Cushing inventory supply. The really big bearish print, though, was not on crude oil. It was on gasoline, building a massive 5.1 million barrels. That's what sent all the prices straight down. And I'll come back to that in just a minute. Distillates building 725,000 barrels, U.S. production ticking up to another all-time record high of 12.9 million barrels. And that's despite the fact that the rig count has been declining for months. Now, a lot of people have explained that by saying, okay, it's the efficiencies of pad drilling. It's the expectation that more and more previously incomplete wells would be completed. There are various technical factors that are making this happen. But I talked to Art Berman about this, and he agreed with me that it's a matter of time. If the rig count keeps declining, eventually that has to catch up with production. And I think when it does, it could create an even larger bullish impetus in the market. But for now, we're seeing new record highs in production, which is a bearish signal. 6.2 million barrels imported this week, a very, very large 3.5 million barrel export print. Now, of course, the tape action off of that very bearish inventory report, primarily owing to the gasoline build, was straight down, took out the five-day moving average, and it was a trapdoor move from there down to the eight-day moving average. But you know what? Then it bounced very exuberantly right back off of the eight, still closing below the five, but just barely below the five and above the volume weighted moving average, which is around 58 spot 10. Didn't quite make 58 spot 17, which was the 5 day moving average by the close. So it looks to me like we had a little setback here due to inventory, but not much of one. I don't see the market crashing from here. There is still this persistent bid that feels like longer-term buyers coming into the market, open interest moving up. Now, there's a video that I want to refer our listeners who have a HedgEye subscription to. It was Keith McCullough interviewing Mark Gordon, who is a fund manager whose views long-term was very fascinating for me to watch this interview. I agree very strongly with Mr. Gordon's conclusions. Ironically, I disagree with him very strongly on a few of the points that led him to those conclusions. I see some of those things differently. But even though we disagree on some of the particulars, we both come to the conclusion that we're nearing the point where we get another phase transition, where we went from the peak oil craze of 2008, $147 oil prices, all of this fear and worry that we were somehow running out of oil, which was never true, but it drove prices crazy higher. Then we had the period of abundance with shale being massively financed by the liquidity that the central banks have put into the system, creating an overinvestment in the shale patch, in my opinion, flooding the market with oil. We're still in that phase, but it feels like maybe that phase is coming to an end. And when that plays out, we're eventually going to get to a new period of fears about insufficient supply. I thought we were going to get through a recession first before that happened. I really found Mark Gordon's views interesting. So I recommend that one. I believe that interview is only available to HedgEye subscribers. We do, though, still have, Patrick, I think this weekend is your last chance to use those Macro Voices deep discount coupons for a HedgEye subscription. Those are described in your research roundup email, and we discussed them in detail when we had Keith McCullough on the program a few weeks ago. But I really encourage our oil-interested listeners to watch that interview. Meanwhile, we're going to try to get Mark Gordon onto the show at some point. I'd really love to talk to him about how his views differ from my own.
All right, well, let's move on to gold. And here we are, not far from the bottom end of the November range, and gold just can't seem to catch the bid at all. Where's the next move for gold coming in your mind?
Well, we're bouncing off of support at 1450. There's a little bit of round number support, but there's also a Fibonacci level there. Now, I expect that we're going to eventually get through this to the downside and trade lower. Of course, I could be wrong. It's one of the key Fib levels, so it's possible that this will be the bottom. I don't think so. I already bought at this level, 1452, a couple of weeks ago, and so I'm not going to buy any more here. I'm waiting for about 1420. Our friend Ola Hansen at Saxo Bank had a great tweet out the other day. You can look for that on Twitter. It's OLE_HANSEN, the Scandinavian spelling of Hansen. He's got a great chart that shows the Fib levels. They're looking at the big move in oil from its base at 1272 up to the top at 1557. Now, the 38.2% retracement level, the first major Fib level, is 1448. In other words, just a couple dollars lower than where we are right now. I think that's the support that has been holding the market price up. I think we'll probably get through it. The 50% Fib level is at 1415. Now, Ola is drawing this Fibonacci retracement zone from the base at 1272. If I draw it from where the resistance level was at 1350 instead, interestingly, the 61.8% Fib comes in at about 1417. So you got 1415 is Ola's number for the 50% Fib retracement. If you draw the Fib a different way, you get the 61.8 at 1417. And if you look at the channel that exists, the price channel on the chart, that lower channel support line is right around 1418. So right around 1420, let's say 1425 to be safe, is a very appealing area, in my opinion, to start buying gold in size. I'm not convinced that's where it's going to bottom. It's impossible to pick tops and bottoms, but I think it's in a very attractive place. As far as here at 1450, I've already bought some here. I'm not rushing to buy a whole bunch more, but certainly if you have no gold, we are on a key support level. Maybe it's a good time to start averaging in.
All right, well, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yields because, well, we had a backup. We were almost as high as 2% at one point, and we've now trading around the 1.81 level on the 10-year yield. And do you think we're heading back toward 2% here? Where's the next move for the yield?
I've been thinking about this quite a bit in the last couple of weeks, particularly after Charlie McElligott and Keith McCullough's interviews, where they've been talking about a secular return of a trend toward inflation. And, you know, inflation is the enemy of the bond market. It's not here yet. But it seems to me like the fundamental story on Treasury yields is they should go lower still until inflation spoils the party. Well, when is that? We're already starting to see some signs of inflation picking up. So that doesn't mean if you're really good at trading these things that there isn't more money yet to be made on the long side of Treasury bonds expecting lower yields. But I think that party is eventually going to be spoiled when inflation takes off. And I'm not smart enough to know when that's going to be. So I'm on the sidelines. I'm sitting this one out.
All right. Well, this week's featured interview guest is Jeffrey Christian. Now, why did we invite Jeffrey back onto the show this week?
Well, Jeff is a terrific thinker. He's known mostly as a precious metals expert, but he's actually a commodities guy in general, and he's a very good macro thinker, too. We wanted to get a timeless interview that we could air for the Thanksgiving holiday, that we could tape in advance. We decided to do that on electric vehicles, and that was really the original plan for this week's show. But of course, the situation that's set up, Patrick, is we've got Jeff, a precious metals guy, coming on the show this week, and it's to do an interview that has nothing to do with precious metals at a time when our listeners are very interested in precious metals. So we ended up asking Jeff to come back and recorded a second interview that will air in our post-game segment right after the first interview, which is primarily focused on electric vehicles. So let's start there. We'll come back in post-game and get Jeff to give us a much more current update on what's going on with precious metals. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. I did a full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen, the host of this excellent podcast, back on September 7th, 2019. The download link is in your Research Roundup email. We discussed a number of key issues about the value of having a rules-based investment strategy in a portfolio. In our conversation, Neil shared some insights that may surprise you, especially when it comes to how trend-following strategies don't really operate the way some market commentators suggest they do. For more information, including a free book about trend following and the accredited investor slide deck from my interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen, go to toptradersunplugged.com/macro slides. Check them out. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Jeffrey Christian is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is CPM Group founder Jeffrey Christian. I want to let our listeners know that we recorded this particular interview all the way back in early February 2019. So we won't be up to date on the latest market developments, but it won't matter because we're going to talk about two really important subjects today that I really appreciate Jeff giving us the time to give us his perspective on. One is electric vehicles and where energy is going to come from in the future. The other is the changing role of where Russia and China fit into the geopolitical stratosphere, and particularly how the views in China and Russia differ from views that we in the United States might have about China and Russia. So, Jeff, thanks so much for joining us in the program. Why don't we go ahead and dive into electric vehicles, your first topic. My question, first question, where's the energy going to come from? And don't say electric or hydrogen, because those are not energy sources. Those are ways of delivering energy that has to be generated some other way. So where is energy going to come from, if not oil, in the future?
It's interesting because, you know, I wrote a book on electric vehicles in 1979, and Stuart Brand reviewed it, and he said, Mr. Christian is a shill of the nuclear power industry, because the only way you could have electric vehicles is to have a massive build of nuclear power plants. And it's funny because in 1979, I was not exactly a shill of the nuclear industry, and in fact, participated in this million-person march against nuclear power in Manhattan after Three Mile Island. But, you know, Stuart came along in the mid-aughties, and he wrote an article, I think it was in Mother Jones, saying, I was wrong about nuclear power. If I look at the world's need for electricity, and I look at the environmental degradation that's caused by various energy sources, and I'm wholly aware of the limitations of really building enough solar and wind and tidal wave capacity to have all of this stuff be coming from renewable sources, I have to conclude that nuclear power is the least offensive environmental source of the volumes of electricity that the world will require going forward. So I wrote him a note and I said, so who's the shill of the nuclear power industry now? But he never wrote back. It's a real problem. And clearly, if you look at like the International Energy Agency in Paris, and you look at other people's views, nuclear power probably is going to factor in. Now, one of the things that has happened is that solar power and wind power and hydropower are coming along faster and further than a lot of people thought. And they are becoming much more important. And they're also important in terms of, you mentioned hydrogen, because A, they generate electricity, but also they can be used to generate hydrogen if we were to succeed in moving to a hydrogen economy. So I think that, you know, when you start looking at it, it's going to be a combination of fuels, including hydrocarbons, including nuclear, including solar and wind power, you know. And it's interesting because in the metals business, all these people are talking about how a third of the cars being built in 2025, 2030 are going to be electric. And the auto industry and the electric generating industry and the electric grid operators say there's no way that we can meet that kind of demand for like 33, 35 million cars a year. We can't produce enough components. We can't produce enough electricity. And the grids are not stable enough to deliver that electricity in virtually all parts of the world.
So is that answer essentially there has to be a nuclear renaissance, or is it still up in the air as to what happens?
I think think it's up in the air, and I think what you're going to see is a variety of power sources, but I do think that nuclear power will have to come back. And, you know, if you look at the nuclear industry and if you look at the power generated by it, it's amazing because in the United States, for example, we haven't really built a new nuclear power plant since the 1970s, but nuclear as a share of energy sources is much higher today than it was in the 1970s. And that's in a greatly expanded power generation business. What you found is that those nuclear power plants that were built in the 50s, 60s, and 70s have been retrofitted and upgraded. And A, they're living far longer than people thought they would. And B, they're generating far more electricity. So I do think that there is the scope for a nuclear renaissance. But, you know, you do have political and social problems with it. And you do have the problems that when things go bad with a nuclear power plant, they go bad big time in a devastating way.
Let's go ahead and get into your presentation for the benefit of our listeners. There is a slide deck that Jeff put together to accompany this interview. You can find the download link next to Jeff's picture on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Jeff, as we dive into this starting on pages 2 and 3, what is going to be the motive power of the future? Where are we going to get the energy to run vehicles and what metals are going to come into play? Are there battery technologies or other uses of metals that come into this story?
It's interesting because if you go back a few years from when we're talking, so if you go back to 2017, 2016, there was a tremendous uncertainty as to what the motive power, the propulsion technology of choice would be in the future. Was it going to continue to be gasoline and diesel, the petroleum fuel, or compressed natural gas, electric vehicles, hybrids? Fuel cell vehicles are still being talked about, and we like hydrogen engines. But by 2018 into 2019, what you've seen is there's been a shift in attitudes in the automotive industry and in related industries and markets. And the view now is that electric vehicles are probably the big winners of all of those, at least for the foreseeable future. So we have a chart in that deck where we show our market share by engine type between now and 2050. And it goes out a third of a century, and people say, you know, how can you project a third of a century? But because of the long introductory nature of new technologies of this sort, you really have to go out that far. And our view is that, you know, between now and 2050, electric vehicles are the winners. So in 2017, 2018, about 1% of the new vehicles being built were electric, pure electric. Our view is that by 2050, maybe a third of them are electric, which means that two-thirds of them are still burning petroleum fuels, basically. But when I look at electric vehicles, the way I phrase it to myself late at night is, are electric vehicles 8-track cartridges or CDs? And I think they're CDs, not 8-track cartridges. 8-track cartridges were a technology that was introduced that didn't really take off. It was around for 10, 15 years, and then it disappeared. CDs, in contrast, are a technology that really started to appear in the early 1980s, and it took off big time, and it destroyed the cassettes and the vinyl industries for all intents and purposes. And it became the mode of choice for having music delivered to your home. And now they're pretty much gone because everybody's gone digital. And I think that electric vehicles are sort of that kind of technology. When you look at a new technology, you say, how is this going to be introduced? And there are people who are looking at electric vehicles and say, well, whenever you get a new technology, it's introduced very quickly. Look at cell phones and look at digital cameras. But those are technologies that offer better utility to consumers at lower costs. And they get adopted quickly and they take over. Electric vehicles offer less utility at higher costs. So that's not the right paradigm. The paradigm are CDs. CDs cost 2-3 times as much as vinyl and cassettes when they were introduced, but they were a higher fidelity and a higher quality, and people were willing to pay for them until such time as digital delivery over the internet came and basically destroyed the CD market. So my view is, you know, over the next third of a century, I think electric vehicles are the winners. But over the next 100 years, I'm not sure that electric vehicles will be the winners. Electric vehicles may be a interim technology that we move to because of the pollution and the environmental issues related to petroleum. But that ultimately, I think we do pivot to a hydrogen economy. And 100 years from now, electric vehicles are as rare as diesel or gasoline-powered vehicles will be.
Okay, well, let's, before we move on past electric vehicles, because that's a trend that you show growing astronomically out through 2050, I want to talk about where the investment play is there, because you talk to a lot of investors, they'll tell you, okay, you got to look at lithium mining. It's all about lithium mines. Well, wait a minute. Lithium ion is just one battery chemistry, and there's a lot of research being done on other battery chemistries because lithium ion has some challenges that have led to fires and other things. So is it smart to be thinking of this electric vehicle trend that you see coming as a lithium metal trend, or is it really something very different than that? Because I think a lot of people think of it that way.
Well, that's the problem. Our third chart is this hierarchy of uncertainties. What will be the motive power of the future? Will it be electric or hybrids or hydrogen or gasoline? You know, and if it's electrics, what battery technologies will it be? And if it's lithium ion batteries, what kind of lithium ion batteries? Because there's just an enormous range of batteries, and there are new technologies coming in. And everybody in the auto industry and the electric vehicle industry, in the battery industry, are playing, it's like a roulette table, and they're playing their several slots, you know, because they don't know where it's going to go. We have cautioned our investors not to get into lithium mining, at least, because A, there's plenty of lithium out there, and SQM in Chile and a few other properties in Chile and Argentina can supply all the lithium that the world might possibly need. In addition to which, if you do see lithium ion batteries coming along, both for electric vehicles and for electricity storage systems in homes and offices and other applications, you will have a lithium recycling industry. The dirty secret is that lithium ion batteries are recyclable, but they're not recycled. Recyclers take them and they recover the cobalt from them, and then they burn off the lithium right now. That's going to change, and you'll see lithium recycled. Battery manufacturers don't like recycled lithium right now, but they'll learn to like it, as other industries have learned to like recycled lead and copper and other, and steel and iron. So there's just a great uncertainty. So we've cautioned people against investing in upstart exploration lithium mines outside of South America. And we've also cautioned people away from cobalt, because cobalt is being engineered away from the batteries now. They're moving to nickel sulfate and manganese sulfate. But, you know, it's interesting because while the cobalt sulfate used in lithium ion batteries is a significant portion of the cobalt market, the lithium sulfate and manganese sulfate used in batteries will be a small part of much larger markets that are primarily ferroalloys. So it's not necessarily nickel and manganese mining that will benefit from the electric vehicle industry. It'll be the chemical processors who take that nickel and manganese and make other things. And then you have the whole issue of, well, will it even be lithium ion batteries? If it is, will we go to solid state dry electrolytes, and all of a sudden you solve the thermal runaway issue and you don't have to worry about cobalt and manganese? There's just so many questions out there as to how this technology evolves that it's very hard to figure out where to invest. And that factors back into the auto industry too, because they go to the original equipment manufacturers and they say, we need you guys to build billions of dollars worth of motor factories and electrical controller factories and continuous variable transmission factories and manganese sulfate and cobalt sulfate factories, but we may never need your products. So please invest billions of dollars in these technologies, and we may be there as a customer. And, you know, the OEMs say, I'm sorry, we can't do that. And the auto industry says, well, we can't give you any price or volume guarantees because, A, we're not in all that great shape financially, and B, we just, the uncertainty is too great. So that's going to slow the introduction of electric vehicles. and it's going to compound the problems with investors deciding, you know, what industries they should invest in to take advantage of the electric vehicle introductions and revolution.
Now, the electric vehicle story is one which is very widely discussed, but a less discussed couple of trends are fuel cells and hydrogen. And hydrogen comes into play both as a type of fuel cell and also the use of hydrogen and hydrogen engines independent of fuel cells. So why don't we start with fuel cells? What's a fuel cell and why should we care?
A fuel cell is sort of like a battery, and they use hydrogen, they oxidize hydrogen, and that produces electricity, and then you can use that electricity to power a car or other things that might use electricity. The trouble, there are several problems with fuel cells, and one of which is that they don't work very well. The technology has been around for probably a century, and it's always been the power source of the future. It's never quite been able to be commercialized. There are people who are looking at fuel cells. For example, Amazon and Walmart have fuel cell forklifts in a few of their warehouses. And what they're finding is that for these things to be commercially and financially viable, the fuel cell stacks need to last 5 years, and they don't. They don't even last a year. You know, I visited a fuel cell manufacturer in Germany years ago, and they were making fuel cell units for home heating. And I was looking at them, and they said, okay, you know, for this thing to, the payback requires these fuel cells to last like 8 years or longer. And the payback was, I think, maybe 20 years. But they only warrantied their stacks for 18 months. Yeah, so it just didn't work technically. They're not reliable enough. And the math and economics don't make sense. So we've been a fuel cell skeptic since I started looking at alternative energy technologies in the 1970s. And we continue to be. The platinum industry has been promoting them, but the fuel cell manufacturers have largely engineered platinum out of the fuel cells so that even if you did see a fuel cell industry come along, and I don't think you will, they're not going to save the platinum industry in South Africa.
Let's move on to hydrogen in the context of not being a fuel cell. Now, hydrogen is, I think, the most abundant atom in the universe, but it's also kind of explosive. So how would you power a vehicle with hydrogen and not have a risk of it basically being a rolling bomb?
Well, that's true of fuel cells or hydrogen engines. I'm very much interested in hydrogen engines because in 1806, the first internal combustion engine was invented by a fellow in France, and he used hydrogen as his fuel. And it was a proof of concept type of thing. He built an internal combustion engine. He used hydrogen, and he showed that an ICE works. And he knew at the time hydrogen doesn't make sense because it's explosive and it's hard to make and it's hard to safely ship, store, and use. And that was 1806. It was about 57 years later when commercial production of petroleum started in western Pennsylvania. So, you know, invention was the mother of necessity. He invented the internal combustion engine. He showed that it worked with hydrogen. And then they went off and discovered that they could distill petroleum into kerosene and gasoline and other fuels that they could use in internal combustion engines. So hydrogen engines are a proven technology, and they're a very interesting technology. The problem with fuel cells, one of the problems with fuel cells and one of the problems with hydrogen engines is how do you safely ship, store, and distribute hydrogen? And we've been working with a company that is looking at liquid organic hydrogen carriers. And this is a very interesting technology because what you do is you take an organic, a common organic liquid, and you hydrogenate it. You add hydrogen atoms to it. And that gives you a liquid that, in the case of our client, the liquid has a volatility and toxicity similar to gasoline or diesel. So you can ship it, you can store it, and you can distribute it through the existing infrastructure that is used to distribute gasoline and diesel. You have a little bit of retrofitting on the technology, but you save, you know, $40 trillion in the United States in terms of building a hydrogen distribution system. And more importantly, what you do is you have a liquid that is safer to use and store and ship. Now, the platinum industry in South Africa says, well, if we can get hydrogen safely and affordably distributed, then fuel cells take off. But the auto industry says, no, no, no. Understand this. A petroleum-based internal combustion engine costs about $3,000. And they're pretty complex nowadays because of environmental controls and fuel injection systems and things like that. An electric battery pack for a vehicle costs about $10,000, depending on what kind of vehicle. A Nissan Leaf is obviously lower cost than a Tesla 3. A fuel cell stack costs $30,000, has higher operating costs, higher maintenance, and doesn't work too well. And a hydrogen engine costs about $1,500 to make. So it costs about half of what a current petroleum-based internal combustion engine costs to make. It has fewer moving parts. It has reduced operating costs and maintenance costs. So the auto industry says, if I can get safe and affordable hydrogen distributed to the pump, I'm going to build hydrogen engines. And, you know, Ford and BMW worked with a company that was called Energy Conversion Devices. They demonstrated a 300-mile range on a Ford Focus probably about 13 years ago. So it's technology that's out there. And, you know, what it comes down to, with the fuel cells, you have to deal with getting the hydrogen safely and affordably distributed and then making the fuel cells work. With a hydrogen engine, you just have to get the hydrogen safely and affordably distributed. If you can do that with liquid organic hydrogen carriers, then you pivot quickly from petroleum-based internal combustion engine to a hydrogen internal combustion engine. It goes back to what I was saying about technological innovation. If you can deliver something that's cheaper and has improved use characteristics, that will be introduced much more quickly. So hydrogen engines have the capacity to A, revolutionize the energy market, revolutionize the petroleum industry, and revolutionize global politics, because all of a sudden, certain big parts of the world don't matter the way they used to because you don't need the petroleum.
I want to come back to my first question, though, because hydrogen is not an energy source. Although it is the most abundant atom in the universe, hydrogen in its raw and burnable form has to be created through some energy-intensive process. And the ones that I know about are specifically electricity-intensive. So if you've got to have a lot of electricity in order to manufacture the hydrogen in the first place, why wouldn't you just use that electricity to recharge your electric vehicles?
There are several things that are going on there. And, you know, first up, most commercial hydrogen production right now is byproduct of petroleum refining. So you have this catch-22 that if you replace petroleum refining with hydrogen, you don't have that hydrogen. There has been a lot of work looking at using electrolysis, you know, of water to produce hydrogen and oxygen from water. And it is very energy intense because hydrogen loves to build bonds and it hates to break them. So it's very energy intensive to break water down into hydrogen and oxygen. There's been some interesting work with solar and wind power. And again, the power generating industry and the power distributing industry, the grid operators, are looking at this because one of the things that they're facing, both with nuclear power and also with wind and solar, is you generate the electricity when the sun's shining and the wind's blowing. And then you have to store it because those are sometimes off-peak times. So they need a tremendous amount of storage capacity. And some of the utilities are now saying, well, we can use that excess electricity generated in off-peak times to break down water, store the hydrogen, and then use the hydrogen. You oxidize it, you recombine it to produce water. And that's an extremely heat-generating reaction. And then you can use that to generate electricity through turbines or other applications. So there are obviously energy losses breaking down, converting electricity into hydrogen, taking the hydrogen, oxidizing it to produce electricity. But there are other things that are efficiencies that are on an overall utility scale make more sense doing that. And again, then you say, well, if I'm producing that electricity, can I produce it from hydrogen? Do I become a self-fulfilling circle? No, you're still going to need electricity from other sources. And that's something that has to be solved.
Jeff, if we're going to replace petroleum as the center of everything in vehicle use with hydrogen, first of all, does that mean that it's nuclear-sourced energy? But particularly, does that maybe change the balance of power around the world? Because right now, a whole lot of how geopolitics works on this planet has to do with who's got the oil versus who needs the oil. If it was not oil that we needed, what else would it be that we did need instead? And would that be uranium or something else? And who's got it? And how does that change the balance of power around the world?
Yes. First off, you're probably still going to need petroleum for a long period of time, you know, decades more. But if you start shifting to different types of power, nuclear or hydrogen-based or whatever, you're going to change the political power structure in the world. In the Middle East, you know, there's a joke that my grandfather rode a camel, my father drove a Mercedes, I fly a jet, and my grandson will ride a camel. And you have any number of countries that, A, have been the focal point of ongoing problems in terms of international politics and international political stability. And all of a sudden, those countries would become far less important as a source of petroleum if you were pivoting away from petroleum to hydrogen or nuclear power. The other thing is, you know, my good friend Dick Cheney, and I say that sarcastically, Cheney gave a big speech in 1998, I believe, in London, in which he said, you know, the two big prizes in the world are, first off, Middle Eastern hydrocarbons. But more importantly, he said, the hydrocarbon industries of the former Soviet Union, which he felt very strongly were at risk, since proven somewhat true, of falling back under the control of the Russian and other regional governments in a way that would be less advantageous for Western oil companies and oil service companies like Halliburton, of which he was the head at the time. So all of a sudden, you change the international politics, and petroleum becomes less important, and you start seeing wind, solar, and nuclear. And nuclear becomes different because uranium is much more evenly distributed around the world, and obviously there are certain countries that would do better and certain countries that wouldn't do better. But like the United States, Canada, Australia, Namibia, there are any number of countries that have uranium for nuclear power. So you would change all of the dynamics of the global political structure if you pivoted away from petroleum.
Well, that's a perfect segue into our next topic, which is China and Russia, because something I've certainly noticed is the view inside the United States about China and Russia versus what I gathered from living in Hong Kong of you know, how Chinese people think about China is very, very different. So tell us economically, where did China fit in the world economy? But more importantly, how has that changed in the last 10 years? And how do you expect it to change more in the next 10 years?
It's an interesting one because, you know, China probably was about, well, it was 6% of world GDP in 2008. And it's probably closer to about 12 or 13% now. And the World Bank estimates are that by 2030, at the latest, it'll be about 15 or 16% of world GDP going up further. So China is clearly growing rapidly and growing rapidly as a percentage of the world. And that's important because the Chinese government and the Chinese people want a fair place at the table. It's interesting because, yes, in the United States, people, especially politicians, tend to talk about fearing Chinese hegemony and excessive power. But if you talk to the Chinese government leaders and the Chinese business leaders and Chinese people, what they really want is a fair representation. Now, their view is that, you know, maybe not 2030, but by 2050, they will be the largest economy, and they should have a lot to say about the state of the world as the largest economy. But what they really seem to want and what they talk about across topics is moving toward a multipolar world. So a multipolar political system, a multipolar currency regime. They don't want the yuan to replace the dollar as the de facto reserve currency. They want a currency system where the liquidity of any number of countries' currencies is sufficient that those currencies can be used as quasi-reserve assets by people around the world. And they also want changes in domestic monetary regulations so that people can say, I want to hold a certain portion of my wealth in dollars and a certain portion in euros and a certain portion in other currencies, which in many countries you can't do right now. But the Chinese attitude seems to be, we would like to see a multipolar world. And we're not necessarily going after hegemony. There's this very interesting dynamic that you pick up in China. And it's the way I would explain it is that across topics, it could be in the gold business, it could be in the molybdenum market, it could be in international politics, across topics and subjects, the Chinese say that they want to strive for what China wants, but they must never be seen as making demands on the world. And there's this weird thing because obviously, you know, they say they want free trade, but it's free trade as a Chinese communist government would define it. They want mutually beneficial trade, but from the context that they will be the larger, more powerful trading partner in that bilateral trade. They do actually want to avoid colonization, and that comes into play with their One Road, One Belt move, which is actually, A, they want to help those countries build up. B, they want to have access to those countries for raw materials and other things. But C, they really want to try to help those countries protect themselves from imperialistic pressures from other countries. And you do that by building up your economy and your political system in all those different countries. And they also have this whole thing about avoiding interference in other countries' domestic affairs. And when you ask them about that, they say, well, we tried that in the past and it never worked out well. You know, so I think the Chinese have this view of where they'd like to see the world move. And they understand it's a long, slow process. And they want to do whatever they can to help that process occur. And they get a little bit stymied by the U.S. when the U.S. says, no, you're trying to take over the world.
Now, speaking of taking over the world, if you listen to U.S. news media, it sounds like we ought to be worried about the aggression that suddenly has developed coming from Russia. But people in Russia actually have the opposite perception. They tend to think it is the U.S. that is the source of the aggression. So how does that dichotomy get explained?
There's a lot of stuff. And, you know, first off, I don't want to sound like an apologist for Russia, because Russia has its issues. But, you know, there's a cultural thing in Russia where they look at the world from Russia, not from the United States. And they see Russia, and then they see what they sort of see the call the hinterlands, which are the countries immediately surrounding Russia that traditionally Russia has had a lot of power and influence in. And they see that as a buffer. And you saw that in the Soviet era with Eastern Europe and the stands, which they actually annexed into the Soviet Union for a while. And the Russians, I think, as a culture, and you have to be careful that you don't overly generalize, the Russians as a culture are worried about outside pressures. And they have good reasons to be worried, and they have bad reasons to be worried. If you take a broader historical view, and you go back to 1830, 1820, I have a chart in my deck about this. In 1820, China was 33% of the world GDP, and India another 16%. So those two countries represented half of the world's GDP. France and Russia were tied for third place. So Russia was like the second large, Russia was the largest or tied for largest economy in Europe. And it was the largest economy, along with France, outside of China and India. And over the years, that deteriorated. So they got down to something very small, like 1.9% of global GDP of the global economy in 2008, and probably even less in 2000 if you went back and looked. And so they feel that they have suffered a great diminution of their status in the world. They would like to rebuild it, but they also feel that they can't rebuild it for a variety of reasons. One is that they don't have the systems and resources that China and India have to rebuild their economies. But in addition to that, they do feel set upon by the United States. And there's any number of things that the U.S. government has done and done repeatedly that causes that Russian suspicion. And you can go back to the years following World War I and the Russian Revolution, when the United States and Britain were funding revolutionaries to fight the Soviets. And U.S. hostilities toward Russia probably predate the Soviet Revolution in 1917. But in current times, it's funny because I was talking to some Russian government people a few years ago, and I was talking about things that occurred in 1998 and 1999 and in the 80s under George W. Bush and Richard Cheney's presidency. And they were saying, no, this is not a George W. Bush, Richard Cheney problem. This goes back to George H. Bush, and it goes back to the Clinton era. And the U.S. government has repeatedly done things which would cause any country to view the U.S.'s intentions with great suspicion. So they have a lot of justification for being paranoid about what the U.S. is doing.
Well, Jeff, what is it specifically that the U.S. has done, which from a Russian perspective is evidence of U.S. aggression as opposed to U.S. responding to Russian aggression, the story that we hear in the U.S. news media?
I'll give you a few points. In 1990, the U.S. government agreed with the Russians orally that if the Russians allowed Germany to reunify, that we would not expand NATO beyond Germany. And obviously we did. We brought in Poland. We brought in some of the former Soviet republics. And when the Russians complained, the U.S. government's response was, well, we never agreed to that in writing. You had problems with Richard Cheney and Wolfowitz. And Putin came in sort of as a reformer, believe it or not. But what he found was that he was trying to reform a Russia that was really in bad shape in 2000, 2001, while the U.S. was very hostile to it. And he took the oligarchs aside and he said, look, here's the deal. I know you stole corporations from the government and rigged bids, and I know you didn't pay taxes for 10 years, and we won't pursue you for those financial crimes if you do two things. One is start paying taxes going forward, and the second thing is stay out of politics. And Mikhail Khodorkovsky famously was arrested because he was, outside of the Putin's party, he was the second largest financier of the Duma elections in 2003. But if you go back to 2 weeks before Khodorkovsky was arrested, he was on the front page of newspapers around the world talking with Richard Cheney, the vice president of the United States, about the Russian elections that were coming up. So, you know, these guys were very blatant in saying, this is what we're going to do. I mentioned Cheney's speech in London, where he said the big prize is to make sure that we can keep control of Soviet and post-Soviet hydrocarbon assets and keep them out of the hands of the governments there so that we can do business with the people who basically stole those assets. And, you know, that would cause me to be suspicious, too.
Jeff, before I let you go, let's touch on what you do there at CPM Group, because I think a lot of people don't realize it's really more than just gold and silver, which you're extremely well known for. What do you do at CPM Group, and what services do you offer to people?
Right. We offer consulting and research and asset management and investment banking advisory services for assets that are related to commodities. As you can tell from my discussion, I studied Soviet and Chinese politics in university, and I studied political economics in those countries and on a global basis in university. And a lot of that was commodities oriented. Then I got into energy and alternative energy markets, and I wrote about electric vehicles. So what we do is across commodities. Now, most of the stuff is actually precious metals because that's where most of the money is. You know, if you look at the commodities markets, gold, silver, platinum, palladium represent probably less than 2-3% of global new supply of commodities on an annual basis. But if you look at gold as a percentage of commodities being traded and invested in, it's closer to 35-40%. So people will come to us and say, I'm interested in commodities-oriented investments. And as you talk to them, you realize they're really talking about gold or gold and silver. So a lot of what we do is gold and silver because that's where the money is. But we actually look at lithium, cobalt, manganese, molybdenum, vanadium, oil, gas, hydrogen, helium, and we will do research on those markets. And that research and our analysis based on that research drives then the financial consulting services that we provide producers, governments, users, intermediaries, and investors.
Well, Jeff, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, that was a great interview that we had, but like we were saying in the pregame, this was recorded earlier in the year, and so we invited Jeffrey to come back for a continued post-game conversation to get an update as to if anything has changed and what are his current views on the market here. So, Jeff, great to have you back on.
It's great to be back with you guys.
Jeff, you know, before we even get into precious metals, which is what all of our listeners are dying to hear you talk about because it's become such a hot topic, before we even get there, you made a comment in this interview that we pre-recorded about election meddling. Now, back when we recorded that, this whole election meddling story wasn't even a story in the news yet. So maybe you can elaborate a little bit for us.
Well, yeah, what I was talking about was the way the Russians look at the United States and the world, and, you know, that there are issues with the Russians having a cultural concern about being set upon by the world, but that there were real reasons to do that. And I talked about Cheney meeting with Khodorkovsky back in 2003, and clearly meddling and trying to skew the Duma elections that were going on in Russia at that time. You know, that was 2003. Fast forward to 2016, the Russians were quite obviously meddling in the U.S. election. The Republican Congress at the time had closed-door hearings in 2017, 2018, in which they heard about how the Russian government was meddling in the U.S. election. And we were all chastised by it. But, you know, the fact of the matter is foreign meddling in elections goes both ways. And it's gone on for decades, if not centuries. There's nothing too new there. And you have to understand the Russian concerns about U.S. meddling, not only in their elections, but in their politics and in their economy and the bots that we've put into their electrical grid and things like that, in order to understand why the Russians are as hostile toward us as they are.
Well, thanks for sharing that, Jeff, but I wanted to just get you onto the topic of precious metals here. Obviously, we had an extraordinary summer run, the June, July, August push higher in gold and silver were just a phenomenal move. First of all, A, do you believe that that was the beginning of the bull market phase? And how do you interpret the pullback we've had over the last couple of months, giving it back? Is this just a buy on dip? What's your general sense of the precious metals market here?
Well, I do think it was the beginning of upward move in gold prices and to a lesser extent silver prices, although silver prices I do think will rise. But I think that if you understand the nature of the buying that we saw that propelled prices higher from late June into October, then you can understand the pullback. What we saw was a very interesting situation in the second and third quarters. You had short-term investors, generalist investors buying futures, options, forwards, and to a lesser extent, ETFs. You did not have a lot of long-term investors buying physical metal anywhere in the world. You know, China, the United States, India. What we saw was that the rally was off a low base, and it was fueled by short-term investors who were very opportunistic. They said gold prices are very low, silver prices are very low, the world is becoming more treacherous. All of those things that we've been worried about happening in the future looks like it may be closer now. And so you had these short-term investors come in, and the long-term investors who buy and hold this stuff were absent the market. The long-term investors have to be there for the price to be sustainable. And what we've seen over the last several weeks with the price coming off is that some of those concerns have backed away, and the short-term investors have backed away, and the long-term investors still have not come into the market.
Jeff, you've done a lot of work at CPM Group to understand not only the market in the sense of what's going on with precious metals, but the precious metals market itself and how it's evolved. I know you've done some studies there looking at the changing role of how institutional versus retail investors represent this market, and particularly how some of those institutions have changed their habits in terms of how they participate. What insights do you have for us in terms of how the market has evolved and how the big players are participating in it?
It's a really difficult thing to talk about because there's so many factors that are involved. We're seeing these major structural transformations in the buy side of financial markets, not just in precious metals, but across markets. You're seeing institutional investors move away from fundamentally driven, macroeconomically driven decisions. You know, a couple data points. We did a survey of hedge funds, CTAs, CPOs late last year, in late 2018. We had a list of 6,800, very well-qualified, scrubbed list of 6,800 fund managers. Of the 6,800, 132 of them actually traded precious metals futures or options. Most of them were trading financial futures. And of the 132 that were trading this, 35 based their investment decisions on macroeconomics and fundamentals. The other guys were purely looking at price trends, price charts, momentum indicators, and things like that. That's not unique to gold. You're seeing it across the board. Earlier this year, when Barrick made a run at Newmont, the rumor was that BlackRock didn't even have Barrick shares in its portfolio. So we went into the database and we looked. And it turns out that 65 funds run by BlackRock had Barrick shares. Of those 65 funds, five of them were managed by people and looked at the fundamentals of the companies, the industries, and the macroeconomic environment. And 60 of them were index funds or ETFs that were buying Barrick because it was listed on the NYSE, listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange, shows up in the FT Gold Mining Index, shows up in the Toronto Mining Index. So you have this movement away from fundamental and macroeconomic analysis driving investment to purely quantitative type of things, the sort of thing that Marx wrote about in the 1880s. And it's coming true. And that's devastating the buy side. At the same time, the sell side's being devastated by the fact that you're going to electronic trading. You don't need brokers. Brokerage fees and clearing fees have actually plummeted and have gone to zero, not only for institutional investors, but now for retail investors. So the sell side is changing dramatically. You don't have the sell side banks and brokerage houses supporting small mining companies, much less large mining companies, the way they used to. So you've got this major transformation, both on the buy side and sell side of the equity markets and the financial markets, that's really having a devastating effect on the mining industry. And mining executives, I think, have been very slow to pick up that a lot of these changes transcend their sector, and that the problems that they're feeling and the pain that they're feeling in trying to raise money from people who no longer want to invest in mining companies individually is really something that they can't control because it's far beyond the mining industry. It's a much larger issue in the financial markets that has to be dealt with.
Jeff, you mentioned silver earlier, that we've seen lots of activity in gold, not as much in silver. I guess there's two ways to interpret that. One is something's changed and silver is not as attractive. We shouldn't pay attention to it. The other way to look at it would be silver has been overlooked, and that represents an opportunity to buy silver before it moves as big as gold has. Which is it, or is it something different?
I think that it's perhaps neither of those. I think that what you see is that gold is much more money and much more of a financial asset, and that's true around the world. Silver is a more specialized financial asset. You know, people in India and the United States, and to a lesser extent China, see it as quasi-money, see it as a financial asset. It's much more of an industrial metal, and it's viewed in Europe, for example, as a much more of an industrial metal. So I think that what you're seeing right now is a combination of two things. gold is rising because people are worried about the state of the world, the state of the banking industry, the state of financial markets, and they're buying gold as a risk hedge and a portfolio diversifier. And they're buying more gold than silver because they see gold more in that light than they do in silver. In addition to that, you have some people who are looking at silver more as an industrial metal, and they're saying, you know, the dynamics are probably not as strong there. Silver prices rose very sharply from 2005 to 2011, primarily because investors were buying outsized amounts of silver. Since 2012, they've been buying less and less silver. And silver investment demand last year was off 90% from the level that we saw in 2012. So silver prices rose because investors were buying a lot. Silver prices have fallen because investors are buying less. And a lot of other investors look at that and they say, until I see other investors buying more silver, I'm less bullish on silver than I am on gold.
Now, moving on to looking at it from a portfolio perspective, is it more prudent to weigh yourself more toward owning the precious metals themselves? Or do you see that the opportunity is more in the miners themselves? How would you weigh yourself in a portfolio between miners and the actual precious metals?
It's funny because, you know, one of the nice things about gold is it does a lot of different things in a portfolio. And one of the things about gold mining is it does a lot of things in the gold in a portfolio. I tend to lean more toward gold. And I think that people should have some physical gold and silver as insurance policy. They should also trade gold and silver on a shorter term basis to take advantage of the opportunities to buy and sell the metal. Mining shares are good for really two different reasons. One is they give you a leverage exposure to gold and silver because typically they have a higher beta greater than one relative to the gold and silver prices. So if the gold price rises, if the silver price rises, the mining company shares should probably outperform on a percentage appreciation basis, and it gives you a leveraged exposure to the gold and silver bullion markets. And then the other thing is that some of these mining companies actually do well and they return dividends and their share prices appreciate. So gold mining companies and silver mining companies can be a good way to make money. The problem is that it's a very crowded market and a lot of the mining companies haven't really performed for investors over the last 5 to 10 years. So they're kind of in the dogs. So when I'm talking to one of our investor clients, we will usually propose a diversified precious metals portfolio, which includes some physical metal, some futures and options trading, and some mining shares.
Right. So I wanted to ask you about the other precious metals, because platinum has more or less behaved like gold and silver, pulled back since the summer. But palladium continues to edge back to its year highs. I mean, we're just hovering around the 1800 mark. What's your feeling about these precious metals? And is there more like upside on palladium prices from here?
Well, you know, our view is that palladium prices probably are close to their peak. We don't see them falling because the palladium market is tight and getting tighter. We have, I guess, a little bit of a surplus this year and next year. That could cause the palladium price to plateau. But the palladium market, it remains relatively tight with strong fabrication demand relative to total supply. Platinum prices, in contrast, are basically bouncing around multi-year lows, and they haven't been able to really stage a major rally. They're trading around $900 right now. We think that ultimately over the next couple of years, they could go to $1,000. Ultimately, they could go a lot higher because our expectation is that South African Platinum Group Metals production will probably fall over the next 5 years while demand for the PGMs will continue to rise. So we expect the platinum price to tighten, the platinum supply demand balance to tighten. And we think that that will lead to at least a short period of time when the platinum price is rising, but it's probably several years out. Palladium is a much more positive story. And I think that one of the things that you'll see and one of the things that you're possibly seeing in the South African mining industry now is that these companies are finally stopping considering themselves as platinum miners and they're considering themselves as platinum group metal miners, because the palladium market, the rhodium market, iridium and ruthenium, all of those markets are much more positive and dynamic. They have much stronger fabrication demand and much tighter supply demand balances and lower inventories, except for palladium, than platinum. So I think that the platinum industry in South Africa is, you know, finally capitulating and saying we may have to overproduce platinum in the long run because we need to get at these other metals.
Well, Jeff, thanks so much for joining us again. We look forward to getting you back on the show in a few months for another update. Today's episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Be sure to check out my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen, published on September 7th, 2019. The link is in your Research Roundup email. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. And, of course, if you have not yet, please register your free account at macrovoices.com. It only takes a few minutes. We won't spam you or try to sell you anything. We'll just send you our free Research Roundup email blast every week, which contains links to all of the best free research that we could find on the internet each week, including download links for our own featured content here on the Macro Voices podcast. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book for Jeffrey's presentation. There's also an article about the Fed's Brainard arguing for capping interest rate levels during the next downturn. There's also a link to an interview with Barton on repo liquidity, POMO, QE, and more. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll consider including it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, happy Thanksgiving to all our listeners, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.